first Testament lesson is Ezekiel 47, 1 through 12. And if you like, please follow along with the reading on page 817 of the Old Testament in your pew Bible. Just as a definition to make this passage a little clearer, because I thought I wanted to know myself, a cubit equals 18 inches. And the title of this is Water Flowing from the Temple. Then he brought me back to the entrance of the temple. There, water was flowing from below the threshold of the temple toward the east, for the temple faced east. And the water was flowing down from below the south end of the threshold of the temple, south of the altar. Then he brought me out by way of the north gate and led me around on the outside to the outer gate that faces toward the east. And the water was coming out on the south side, going on eastward with a cord in his hand. The man measured 1,000 cubits and then led me through the water, and it was ankle deep. Again, he measured 1,000 and led me through the water, and it was knee deep. Again, he measured 1,000 and he led me through the water, and it was up to the waist. Again, he measured 1,000 and it was a river that I could not cross, for the water had risen. It was deep enough to swim in, a river that could not be crossed. He said to me, "Mortal, have you seen this?" Then he led me back along the bank of the river. As I came back, I saw on the bank of the river a great many trees on the one side and on the other. He said to me, "This water flows toward the eastern region and goes down into the Arabah. And where it enters the sea of stagnant waters, the water will become fresh. Wherever the river goes, every living creature that swarms will live, and there will be very many fish once these waters reach there. It will become free, and everything will live wherever the river goes. People will stand fishing beside the sea from Enjedai to Eglim. It will be a place for the spreading of nets. Its fish will be of a great many kinds, like the fish of the great sea. But its swamps and marshes will not become fresh. They are to be left for salt. On the banks, on both sides of the river, there will grow all kinds of trees for food. Their leaves will not wither, nor their fruit fail, but they will bear fresh fruit every month because the water for them flows from the sanctuary. Their fruit will be for food and their leaves for healing." The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
We turn our attention now to the book of Revelation. And what you're going to hear in this 22nd chapter are echoes of this piece of Ezekiel. And just real quickly, we'll talk more about it, but the Ezekiel passage is a vision that was given to Ezekiel when he was with the exiles in Babylon. Jerusalem had been destroyed, and people were afraid they had no future. And Ezekiel gets this sort of beautiful vision of the new temple. And now you're going to hear the New Testament image of this, for a people who, though not in exile in Babylon, are under the thumb of the Roman Empire. And again, you'll hear the same images coming through. "Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. On either side of the river is the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month. And the leaves of the tree are for the healing of the nations. Nothing accursed will be found there anymore, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads, and there will be no more night. They need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and they will reign forever and ever. And he said to me, "These words are trustworthy and true. For the Lord, the God of the spirits of the prophets, has sent his angel to show his servants what must soon take place. See, I'm coming soon. Blessed is the one who keeps the words of the prophecy of this book." The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
They had trashed it. That is the only way to describe what they had done to the manse at my former church. Now, for those of you, the word manse may not mean anything. It's the same as parsonage. It's a church-owned home in which ministers were allowed to live. Because for long periods of time, churches didn't have enough money to pay a minister both a salary and money to buy a house with, so they had manses. This church had at least one or two at one point. But the manse at my former church sat literally on the church property right next to the parking lot, and Cindy and I had lived there twice. The second time we lived there, after we moved out, it was empty for a while, and then one of our members said, "My son is leaving the Navy. They're moving back to San Antonio. And he has a wife and a couple of children. Could they live in the manse? They don't have a lot of resources." And the session, and me, we were thrilled. Absolutely. He has served his country. We need to help him. And so they came and moved in. And I don't know how long, maybe 9, 10 months, a year perhaps had gone by. And there were no issues as far as we could tell. And then one day, the man's son called me and said, "Something's wrong with the disposal." And being the sort of pseudo-fix-it guy I am, I said, "Sure, let me run over and I'll take a look." And I walked in the front door, and I'm not even sure what I thought. The corners of all the walls where the wood came together had been chewed off by their four dogs. We had been told they had one, and four big dogs had eaten all of that. And the carpet that Cindy and I had put in, this very nice carpet, was, well, not the same color because of the four dogs. And their children had taken this glow-in-the-dark glue stuff and drawn all over the walls. And it appeared as if they had not ever cleaned. It just was totally and absolutely trashed. And my guess is any of you who've ever had rental property and have been landlords, you understand. And I have to say, my first thought beyond the shock was to ask, is it really worth fixing? Okay, over the last couple of weeks, I've wondered if that's what God has been thinking with God's creation. Is it really worth fixing? Because, my friends, we have trashed it worse than those people trashed the manse. Charlottesville. Racism, hatred, neo-Nazis, anti-Semitism. Barcelona. I'm going to wake up this morning and I'm going to drive a truck down the street and kill innocent people that I have never met. A tractor trailer pulled into a Walmart parking lot in San Antonio a couple of weeks ago. Almost 100 degrees out, and inside, packed like sardines, are human beings, and the driver of the tractor simply had gone out for dinner while he let them die in it. Sierra Leone, where people had stripped off all of the trees on the hillsides to find fuel for their fires to cook with, and then the rains came and it inundated a village, killing more than 100 people. And then out in the Pacific, and I like this one because it's compared to Texas, out in the Pacific is this glob of plastic that people have tossed into the ocean or into streams that fed into the ocean, and it is larger than the state of Texas. We have just, in many ways, just trashed God's creation. And people have been coming to me over the last several weeks wondering if God has given up on us. If God had hands, if God has thrown up God's proverbial hands and said, enough, I am done, this world is not worth fixing anymore. And should they just feel helpless? Well, the gift of this morning's passages, both the Old Testament and New, the Ezekiel and the Revelation, are powerful reminders that God has not given up on us or on this creation, that in fact, God is in the creation renovation business. And I can say that because each of these passages carries through three great themes. The first theme is that God is present, not just was present, God is present. Always has been, always will be. And now the Ezekiel passage, see, I should find someone who's been in my 2-year Bible trek class and make them tell you about this, but I don't want to embarrass them because they know it so well. In Ezekiel, there is this great image, this great metaphor of the glory of God. And the glory of God is literally the presence of God. And the way Ezekiel talks about it is Ezekiel describes the glory of God as being in the temple in Jerusalem, the temple where the people came to worship. And the God is present with them and with God's people. But what happens is that the people of Judah trash God's creation. They trash God's world. They do what they are not supposed to do. They don't take care of the widows and the orphans, the strangers and the sojourners. They're filled with greed and lust and hate and pride. And so they get sent into exile in Babylon. But what's fascinating is this glory of God that was in the temple. You follow Ezekiel, and he talks about it lifting up to the ceiling of the temple, and then moving to the east gate of the temple, and then out of the temple onto the plains of Shinar, which are east of Jerusalem, and then it goes all the way to Babylon. That the glory of God traveled with God's people into captivity, that God never deserted them. And then this image that we read this morning of the waters flowing out of the temple, it is this image given to Ezekiel in exile that God is going to come back to Jerusalem and the temple will be rebuilt and the people will be in their home renewed and refreshed. The glory of God never leaves the people of God. And in the Revelation text, what we see is literally what's happened is this new heaven and new earth that you've heard about, that it is heaven coming to earth. This is the image. Heaven comes to earth. And literally the throne of God and of Jesus Christ that was sort of up there, I suppose, is now down here. That God does not desert humanity, that God is with us always.
The second images that come from these two passages is that God has a blueprint that God's working with. That God is not just sort of playing it by ear, that God has this blueprint for what this renovated creation is going to look like. And what this renovated creation is going to look like are two things. First, there's going to be healing. As we went through both of these passages, what you heard about is this water, and I'm going to come back to this river that runs out of the temple. It runs out of where God is. And there are trees on either side of it, and the leaves of the trees are for healing. In Ezekiel, it is for healing, healing the nation, healing the peoples, healing the world. And in Revelation, the image is healing the nations. Peace, restoration, hope, life. That's part of the blueprint. That's what God is working towards and for. The second part is for sufficiency. How many of you have ever prayed the Lord's Prayer? Okay, all right, good, okay. If you recall, there's a piece in it that says, give us this day our
daily bread.
Right, sufficiency, sufficiency, enough. The image of both of these is that everyone will have enough. The image out of Ezekiel is this wonderful, wonderful metaphor of this river that runs out of the temple, and it gets deeper and deeper and deeper. And in it are all these fish, so many fish that everyone has enough to eat. And not only that, that the marshes aren't going to become fresh water. Why? Because salt is needed for people's sustenance. The blueprint is God will provide. All will have enough. The third piece, I think, is the most difficult of the three pieces, the three pieces of the image. And that is that God will keep working until the job is done. That God will finish the job. How many of you have ever had a renovation done at your house? How many of you have ever had it finished early? How many of you have ever had it finished on time? Okay, there we go. I want your contractors. Right, there are few things more frustrating in this world than to have someone say, yep, I'll be done in 3 weeks by this date, and then you're a month later and they're still messing with stuff and it's not finished, right? And I think sometimes that's the way maybe we feel about God. It's like, God, you promised, here's your blueprint, and you said this was going to happen, and yeah, no, it really doesn't look like what you've promised it's going to look like. So come on, God, where are you? But both of these passages are future visions that say this is what God will do. And God will not give up. God will not quit until it is finished and right. And so where does that leave us? Where does that leave us? I think it leaves us with two things. The first, what it does is it tells us that in an often hopeless world, we are to be people of hope. That even when everything else around us seems to be going crazy and collapsing and it looks as if the world has been totally trashed, we are to be people of hope, believing that God is at work. Believing that God will not give up until it is finished. And that when all around us despair, we are to say, no, there is hope. There is hope. The second place this leaves us is a reminder of our role. And our role is, we are God's subcontractors. God is the general contractor of this creation renovation. You and I are called to be the subs. We are called to be those who get our hands dirty. Now, I can't explain it, why God has chosen us to be God's hands and God's feet and often God's voice in the world as the subcontractors in this project. I have no idea why God would choose us. But God has. We are the subs. And we have work to do. Which brings me to Charlottesville. Been thinking a lot about this over the last week or so. And I think what surprised me most about Charlottesville is that people were surprised by Charlottesville. When the white supremacists and the neo-Nazis and all of their friends and relatives showed up in Charlottesville to protest, people were like, oh, whoa, where did they come from? They've always been there. They've always been there. They were there before the Civil War. When the South fought to maintain slavery. They were there after the Civil War with the rise of the Klan and segregation and Jim Crow laws. They were there in the 1920s when one of my grandfathers, working as an AP reporter, was sent out to cover a lynching, not a legal execution, a lynching. It was there in the 40s when the second race riot happened here in Detroit. If you all are unaware, this is the only city with three race riots: Civil War, World War II, and 69, the uprisings. And the first two were more riots by white people against blacks than it was blacks against whites. It happened here in this area when, as I understand it, for a long period of time, the Jewish community had to have its own country club because they were not allowed in other country clubs. It's always been there. It's never gone away. And in some ways, the way I think about it is, if you use the renovation metaphor, that racism and anti-Semitism and the hatred of it is, it's like wood rot. It's there and you don't always see it, but it is nurtured by the drip, drip, drip of fear and hatred, fear of a loss of place, of a loss of a world that maybe never existed, fear, and that fear turns to hatred and anger. And so what's our role as subcontractors? Our role as subcontractors is to peel back the veneer. It is not to ignore it. Because like wood rot, if you simply ignore it, it just gets worse and worse and worse. Our role as subcontractors, meaning those who follow Jesus Christ, is to peel back the veneer and shine the light of God's love in Christ on all people. It is to speak publicly that all human beings are created in the image of God. that all human beings are created in God's image. It is to speak publicly that all human beings are loved and beloved by God, and therefore deserving of respect and dignity. It is to shine the light, because, my friends, the only thing that changes people is the light of God's love. It is not our anger versus their anger. It is not us attacking them when they attack us. It is showing forth the light of love into people's lives who are full of fear and hate and anger. And so this morning, normally I give you one challenge. This morning I'm going to give you four. Oh, I can hear. I'm going to put these on the website. So don't worry about trying to copy them down or remember them. And these are not my original thoughts. These came from the Reverend Dr. Al Tim, who sent these out, a Presbytery executive who sent these out to all of the ministers, asking if we as ministers would agree to these. And I don't want to just keep them for me. I want to challenge all of you to think about these, pray about these, ponder these, and see if you're willing to shine the light of God's love in these ways. First, to commit to be advocates for peace, justice, equality, and the elimination of racial hatred, prejudice, and bigotry. To be advocates, to shine the light. Two, to educate friends, family, communities, to recognize hate and injustice, and then to work for justice and equality in America. Shine the light through education. To reach beyond the boundaries of comfort in ethnicity and race. To strive together for the beloved community of Jesus Christ. To commit ourselves to shine the light by reaching out beyond our comfort levels. And finally, to stand against, and I'll add this myself, to stand against in peace and in love, in justice and in equality, anytime, any place, and anywhere. For the worst thing we can do is to be silent, to ignore it, because we are God's subcontractors on this creation, building the beloved community by making all human beings know their value and their worth, and to stand against those and up to those who would deny that. And so, my friends, those are my challenges to you on this Sunday, that as we go forth, may we do so shining God's love into a sometimes broken world with the trust and hope that God is with us. Let us pray. Gracious God, we give you thanks that you have not given up on us and on this your world. Give us the courage to stand for love and justice and peace, that we might indeed help make this your world the place you've designed it to be.